This is the daily radio ministry of Pastor Sandy Adams of Calvary Chapel Stone Mountain in Atlanta, Georgia. Pastor Sandy is currently teaching through the Gospel of Matthew. Now let's join Pastor Sandy in the Gospel of Matthew, chapter 5.
Jesus says, "You are the salt of the earth. But if the salt loses its flavor, how shall it be seasoned? It is then good for nothing but to be thrown out and trampled underfoot by men." You know, salt served four primary functions. It was a preservative. It kept the meat fresh. It was a seasoning. I mean, what's a bowl of grits without a little salt? It's a thirst producer. Eat a bag of potato chips and you're dying for a Coke. And it was an antiseptic. It was a means of cleaning out a wound. And this is the influence that we should have on the world around us. Our presence should be like a preservative. It should arrest and slow down the corruption going on around us. Our joy should add spice to the blandness and boredom of this world. We are the salt on the grits. Our winsome witness should create a thirst for God in the people that we know. And the love that we show others should help to heal open wounds of the people around us. We're salt. But we're also light. Verse 14, you are the light of the world. Light's primary function is twofold. First, it drives out the darkness. Light exposes misconceptions and dangers and erroneous thinking. Light reveals the truth. And second, light gives off a warmth. It cures the world's coldness. As a man said of his Christian friend, "I felt more alive when I was around him." Do the people that you know, are your friends, the people in your life, do they say the same thing about you? "I felt more alive when I was around her, when I was around him." This is the kind of invigorating influence that we should have on the folks that we know. Hey, we are the salt of the earth. We are the light of the world. Jesus continues, "A city that is set on a hill cannot be hidden, nor do they light a lamp and put it under a basket, but on a lampstand, and it gives light to all who are in the house. Let your light so shine before men that they may see your good works and glorify your Father in heaven." In other words, what good is a light if it's kept under a basket? What's good is a light if it's buried under a candle? You hang the light in the center of the room so everyone can enjoy its benefit. Notice here, Jesus calls us the light of the world, not the light of the church. That means that we need to get out of the church and we need to be involved in the world around us. We need to let our light shine. That's why you need to coach Little League. And you need to get involved in the PTA or the community association or the bowling league. Don't retreat from the world. Jesus says you are the light of the world, but if the people are going to see your light, you have to be around them. You have to be a part of them. Engage the world around you with a deliberate attempt of being a witness for Jesus Christ. I encourage you to do that. You know, there are two reasons why most unbelievers refuse to trust in Jesus. Two reasons why people are non-Christians. First, they've never met a Christian and been exposed to this light and this love, the salt of the earth. There's another reason, though, they're not Christians. It's because they have met a Christian. And that Christian was not what he said he was. Hey, we all have an influence. With some of us, it's positive. With others of us, it's negative. Guys, let's be salt and light. Our job as Christians is to sprinkle and twinkle. Can you say that with me? We're to sprinkle and twinkle. Remember that this week. In verse 17, Jesus makes an important statement. "Do not think that I came to destroy the law or the prophets. I did not come to destroy, but to fulfill." The intent of the law was to show us how to love God and how to love each other. And yet in the first century, the Jews, particularly the Pharisees, they kept the law out of duty, not love. Their righteousness was a loveless, legalistic kind of self-righteousness. In contrast, Jesus obeyed the law's intent. He fulfilled the law with love. You see, here's the problem with the law. It tells me to do loving deeds, but it fails to impart love into my life. Whereas Jesus fills me with His love so that I can then act in loving ways. I like this poem. To work and run the law commands, but gives me neither feet nor hands. Better news the gospel brings. It bids me fly, then gives me wings. Jesus fulfilled the law by imparting His love into our hearts. He provides a means to live the love that the law required. Now, there were rabbis who believed that the Messiah, when He came, would do away with the law and establish a new standard of righteousness. But Jesus respected the law that was given to Moses. The law had lofty goals. The law was all about love. And Jesus wanted to fulfill those goals by empowering folks to love. This is why Jesus reiterates His respect for the law in verse 18. He says, "For assuredly I say to you, till heaven and earth pass away, one jot or one tittle will by no means pass from the law till all is fulfilled." A jot was the smallest letter in the Hebrew alphabet. The tittle was the smallest stroke on the smallest letter in the Hebrew alphabet. The authority and the longevity of the five books of Moses, as well as all the Bible for that matter, is more certain than the sun coming up tomorrow. Jesus said the earth would sooner pass away than this book prove to be unreliable. This book is powerful. This book, its longevity, its authority is trustworthy. Jesus respected the law. We should too. In essence, Jesus is saying, don't you dare fiddle with the tittle. He says, "Whoever therefore breaks one of the least of these commandments and teaches men so shall be called least in the kingdom of heaven. But whoever does and teaches them, he shall be called great in the kingdom of heaven. For I say to you that unless your righteousness exceeds the righteousness of the scribes and Pharisees, you will by no means enter the kingdom of heaven." Jesus didn't do away with the law. Rather, He said that the true life lived out according to the law is going to produce a righteousness greater than the Pharisees. That's what I want to accomplish in your life. Now, in the minds of the disciples who first heard this statement, I'm telling you, this was staggering. This was shocking. For in Jesus' day, the Pharisees were renowned for their diligence in keeping the law. As a matter of fact, the Jews had a saying at the time, went like this: if only two people go to heaven, one will be a scribe and one will be a Pharisee. I mean, the Pharisees were zealous in their efforts to observe the law. They were meticulous to obey the smallest little details. For example, the law said no work on the Sabbath day. But what constitutes work? Well, certainly carrying a load would be work. But what constitutes a load? Well, here's how the Pharisees defined a load: food the weight of a fig, wine for a goblet, milk for one swallow, honey for a wound, oil to anoint a small part of the body, water to moisten an eye patch, paper to write a note, and ink enough to write two letters. That was a load. So if you went out with a big mouthful of milk, you were carrying a load in violating the Sabbath requirements. According to the Pharisees, a tailor sinned if he walked outside of his house with a pin stuck in his coat. He was carrying a load. It was a sin to lift your young child to your knee and bounce him on your knee on the Sabbath day. You were doing work and therefore sinning. It was a sin to wear your false teeth on the Sabbath day. You were carrying a load. Or attach your artificial leg to your nub. Again, you were carrying a load. Jesus would have agreed, don't work on the Sabbath. But what's more loving, bouncing a child on your knee or making him play over in the corner by himself? You see, the Pharisees had missed the point. Rabbinical righteousness was strict observance of laws, an outward form of righteousness. But Jesus taught love. And in doing so, He fulfilled the law. Jesus said, love and you'll take care of the law. You don't have to worry about the law if you love. You fulfill it. Jesus displayed an inward righteousness that comes from a heart, a righteousness that in his mind was greater than that of the Pharisees. As Christians, Jesus has freed us from the legalism of the law, but he has not freed us from love. Jesus puts love inside us, and he expects us to live out that love in our relationships with others. His righteousness comes from the inside out. Well, in the remainder of chapter 5, Jesus contrasts his righteousness with the righteousness of the Pharisees. In other words, the difference between love and legalism. The Pharisees boasted that they had never murdered anyone. But in verse 21, Jesus says, "You have heard that it was said to those of old, 'You shall not murder, and whoever murders will be in danger of the judgment.' But I say to you," in other words, the Pharisees believe this, "but now I say to you, that whoever is angry with his brother without a cause shall be in danger of the judgment." Now I want you to note up front, not all anger is sin. There are causes that justify our anger. Jesus got angry. You remember? When the Pharisees wanted to judge him, when he healed the man with the withered hand, it says Jesus looked at the people in the room with anger. Jesus got angry. But whenever Jesus got angry, he got angry for the right reason, at the right time, and in the right way. Here Jesus is pointing to the outward righteousness of the Pharisees. They bragged that they had never murdered anyone. But oh my, the unjustified anger smoldering in their hearts was the spiritual equivalent of cold-blooded murder. Jesus is saying, don't be proud that you haven't done the deed when the seed is in your heart. So you've never pulled the trigger. So there are no powder burns or metal filings on your hands. But in your anger, have you blown up your wife and kids? If every angry outburst killed someone, would your morning drive to work end up being a killing spree? Reminds me of the man who was bitten by a dog, that pit bull I showed you this morning. And the doctor started taking tests. And he comes in and he tells the guy, he says, "Man, I hate to say this, but you've got rabies." Immediately, the guy reaches over and he grabs a piece of paper and a pen off of the doctor's desk and he starts writing. The doctor looks at him and he says, "Whoa, wait a minute now. You don't need to write a will. You're not going to die. I mean, this is modern times. We've got medicines today that'll treat rabies." The man answers, he says, "Oh." He says, "I'm not writing a will. I'm just dotting down the names of the people I want to bite." Hey, anger is a sin if it's unjustified and if it's left smoldering in our hearts. Jesus is saying, anger, not just murder, is a sin. Jesus goes on to describe the escalating forms of anger. He says, "And whoever says to his brother, 'Raca,' shall be in danger of the council. But whoever says, 'You fool,' shall be in danger of hellfire." You see, anger is like gasoline. You know, when you go up to the pumps, you get a choice. There are different octane levels, different grades of gasoline, and there are different octane levels of anger. First, there's a suppressed anger, or what Jesus calls anger without a cause. This is the illicit anger that we hold on to, that we nurture, that we sort of just let smolder below the surface. Sometimes it doesn't even have an object. We're just angry. Things aren't going our way. Then there's what we could call an explosive anger. It's the anger that lashes out, that shouts, "Raca." The word "raca" was an Aramaic slang word for empty-headed. "You idiot." It was an insult. And then there's premeditated anger. "You fool." This was more than a simple insult. It was a calculated, deliberate attempt to be vengeful. In other words, you called somebody a fool. It was character assassination. Verse 23. He says, "Therefore, if you bring your gift to the altar," and here is the first step in dealing with anger, "be in the habit of coming to the altar. Are you in the habit of coming to the altar every day, every morning before you leave, every night before you go to bed? Are you in the habit of worshiping God at the altar? Guys, His presence has a way of diffusing and disarming our anger, of changing our hearts. How can we be angry when we are spending time in the presence of a God who loves us and adores us and died to save us? And while you're at the altar, Jesus says, if you remember that your brother has something against you. In other words, if God brings an issue to your mind, if God brings it up, if it's an unresolved, if while you're at the altar in God's presence, suddenly you think of some unresolved conflict with someone and God brings it to your attention, then leave your gift there before the altar and go your way. In other words, it's a mockery to seek harmony with God while you're ignoring the rift you have with a friend. He says, first be reconciled to your brother and then come and offer your gift. Guys, life is too short to spend it angry and mad or to have someone mad at you. That's why we need to pick up the phone or we need to sit down and write a letter. That's why we need to apologize for our part in the drama, and we need to do it today. For Jesus says, agree with your adversary quickly. In other words, keep short accounts. Paul says it this way, don't let the sun go down upon your wrath. You know, before you end the day, settle these accounts. If you know of a rift between you and someone else, go to that person and end it. Settle it. Apologize when it's your part, when you have a part in the problem. Life is too short to spend it angry. There's a Latin proverb, he who goes to bed angry has the devil for a bedfellow. Here's the point, deal with your anger before God deals with you. For he says, agree with your adversary while you are on the way with him, lest your adversary deliver you to the judge, and the judge hand you over to the officer, and you are thrown into prison. Surely I say to you, you will by no means get out of there till you have paid the last penny. Guys, unresolved anger becomes a prison in more ways than one. Deal with your anger or it will destroy you one penny at a time. Jesus also warns us in chapter 5, verse 27. You have heard that it was said to those of old, you shall not commit adultery. But I say to you that whoever looks at a woman to lust for her has already committed adultery with her in his heart. Every guy in this room tonight knows that it's one thing to just look. You see a pretty girl, you say, yeah, Lord, that's a pretty girl. And then you move on. But it's another thing to look to lust. It's the lingering look. It's when imagination takes over the image you've placed in your mind. It's so true. Promiscuity begins in the head long before it ends in the bed. Certainly the consequences of the deed and the seed are different. I mean, you go out and you kill someone, it gets you the electric chair. You know, you go out and commit adultery, you get a venereal disease. Or you break up your family. There's a difference between the aftermath of the deed and the seed. I mean, no other human being may know about the seed of sin in your heart. But in God's eyes, and this is what we need to understand, Jesus is saying, in God's eyes, the seed and the deed are one and the same. They're the same sin, just at a different stage of development. This is why true righteousness begins in the heart. Guys, love overcomes anger. Love overcomes lust. When I love my enemy, I'll treat him as my friend. When I love people, I won't look selfishly at a pretty girl as a means for my own personal gratification. Rather, I'll see her as a person who belongs to God, and I'll honor her in that way. Jesus tells us the way to deal with our anger and our lust is to take radical action. Stop with the business as usual. If you know there's a hostility brewing, leave your gift at the altar and go and be reconciled to your brother. The same with lust. For a lustful heart also calls for drastic action. Notice verse 29. If your right eye causes you to sin, pluck it out and cast it from you. As I mentioned this morning, Jesus didn't intend here to be taken literally. If I can lust with my right eye, I can also lust with my left eye. So what good's it going to do for me to pluck out my right eye if my left one can do just as much damage? You know, it's tragic when disturbed folks have used these words to harm themselves. And it happened again just recently. On January the 8th of this year, a young man, 20 years old, living in northern Idaho. I read about it in the newspaper recently. He cut off his hand with a circular saw because he believed it held the mark of the beast. The news report said that he then cooked it in the microwave and then called 911. But he referred back to these words. He had misused these words that Jesus had spoken. Jesus doesn't mean to be taken literally here. He's using a literary device. He's using a tool of literature. We call it hyperbole. It's an exaggeration for emphasis. When he says pluck out an eye or cut off a hand, Jesus means take drastic action to get rid of the problem. To do whatever it takes not to sin again. That's what he's saying. If your right eye causes you to sin, pluck it out and cast it from you. For it is more profitable for you that one of your members perish than for your whole body to be cast into hell. And again, as we said this morning, if we were going to take it literally and pluck out an eye, there's no way any of us would have nerve enough to do it ourselves. It would require doctor's assistance. There are some struggles with sin that require outside help, accountability, support, counseling when needed. There are some struggles with sin you can't fight on your own, and this is one of them. If you're involved in some kind of addictive behavior, you need to seek some help. And if your right hand causes you to sin, cut it off and cast it from you. Again, what is the source of my problem? What is the cause of my sin? For some of us, chopping off a hand might be the equivalent of canceling our cable subscription. Or restricting our internet access. Or breaking off contacts with certain people who have a bad influence on us. Or even changing my schedule or the route that I drive home from work. Victory requires an uncompromising mindset. He says, for it is more profitable for you that one of your members perish than for your whole body to be cast into hell. In verse 31, Jesus discusses divorce. Furthermore, it has been said, whoever divorces his wife, let him give her a certificate of divorce. Remember, Moses allowed for divorce, but it was never God's desire. It was a concession to man's hard-heartedness. Moses basically said, if the choice is killing each other or getting a divorce, well, go ahead and get divorced, but that's not God's intention. Here Jesus sets the record straight. You know, because the Jews, in understanding Moses' commandment, the Jews had taken it the wrong way. They said, well, wait a minute. If Moses allows for divorce, that must mean that God approves of it. Not so. It was a concession, not a commandment. And here Jesus sets the record straight. But I say to you that whoever divorces his wife for any reason except sexual immorality causes her to commit adultery. And whoever marries a woman who is divorced commits adultery. But I want you to notice the exception. In the case of sexual infidelity, the violated spouse is under no obligation to take back the adulterer and remain in the marriage. In the event of sexual immorality, the violated spouse is free to move on. You see, in the Old Testament, an adulterer was taken out and stoned. That made the offended spouse a widow or a widower and thus free to remarry.
Being on the go is something we're all accustomed to in this culture. The hustle and bustle of life seems to make the days just fly by. For most of us, our smartphones are sort of an extension of our bodies, constantly ringing and dinging, telling us where to be and what the next appointment is. The technology that we enjoy in this day and age is amazing. And while there's certainly no end to the bad things we can find online and through our smartphones, there's also some great kingdom-minded options. We'd like to invite you to download the Sandy Adams mobile app. Our mobile app is available for iPhone, Android, and Windows smartphones. Or log on to sandyadams.org and simply click on the link from the main menu. When you download the app, you'll be able to listen to the most recent messages taught by Pastor Sandy, browse the series archive, and search the archive alphabetically. Finally, when you download the mobile app, you'll also have the opportunity to join us live for our Sunday morning worship service right from your smartphone. Again, to download the Sandy Adams mobile app, simply enter Sandy Adams in the search options of your smartphone's app store, or log on to sandyadams.org and simply click on the mobile app option right on the homepage. And please join us again as Pastor Sandy continues teaching through the Bible right here on Sandy Adams Radio.